Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to The Parenthood. We pride ourselves on looking at parenting from all perspectives, and today's is an unusual one. Holly Branson is an author, businesswoman, philanthropist, and mother of two, soon to be three. Her latest book, Weeconomy, talks about how good, fair, philanthropic business practice will imbue your workforce with a sense of purpose that will, in the long term, benefit your business. Holly, welcome, and thank you for joining me today. Your book is written with candid honesty about your childhood and your adolescence, and also how you found yourself working alongside your father, Richard Branson. And I think what I loved about the sort of introductory part is that you're a very successful and, you know, achieved incredible things. And yet you talk very candidly about how you really wanted to be a mum. And when your co-author interviewed you, he said, "What's your biggest ambition?" And you said, "I really want to be a mum." And that's quite an un-21st century answer. It's kind of not what we teach, or what we're told to teach our children about, sort of feminism. But I did love your honesty there.
Yeah, so I think with that, it was a question in a moment where Freddie and I were really struggling to have kids. And so his question was about legacy. And we'd had 2 years of trying for children naturally, two miscarriages, and actually at that moment I just had a miscarriage, and so all I could think in my head was, you know, I'd actually at the moment I don't mind about the business stuff, that's all going well for me, like every other aspect of life was, I'd been lucky in life, things had gone well for me, and I'd suddenly lost control of an area. And so it was the only thing that was in my head was my legacy. I wanted to be children. So it was tough, and it was quite difficult to open up to a guy, in especially one who we were writing a business book together. But it was the utmost honest answer.
And did you find it easier once you had opened up? Did you feel that it was a sort of weight off your shoulders? Was it good? Did it feel good to open up?
It did feel good to open up. So I to'd and fro'd about how honest to be in the personal chapters of the book, well, the first chapter. But I felt that it was my first book I'd ever written, and for people to know who I was as a person, I had to be as open as possible. And that was very much me in that moment where Freddie and I, you know, had achieved great things in life through you know, our work, but personally we were struggling with having children. And actually, looking back on it, I'm so glad I opened up, because when I was struggling and I read things in magazines and newspapers of other people that were going through it too, it really helped me that I wasn't alone, because I was quite alone within my group of friends. Everyone seemed to be getting pregnant very quickly and naturally. And so it's always nice to know that you're not the only one.
And it's difficult because you obviously don't wish, you know, struggle to conceive on anyone else, but it can feel really lonely. And I think tough times are made easier by comrades in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And now I am very much the go-to person for anyone who's having issues. I'm open-armed, and like all my friends say, "Oh, do you mind if my friend calls you, because you know they've tried for a year or they've had a few failed rounds of IVF?" And I'm like, absolutely, give them my number. I'm here for anyone that needs some advice, because I've been through it. And there aren't that many people out there. There probably are people out there, but there aren't that many people who are very open about it.
Yeah. And you sort of, It's ridiculous because you sort of almost regard it as something that's a failure. Failure to conceive is, you know, it sounds so negative, and yet it's not anything you've done wrong. It's not like you didn't score well enough in your exams. It's just something biological that you really have very little control over. Mm. So why should there be this shame surrounding infertility?
Mm. Yes, I wish I'd opened up about it earlier. Because even to my own friends, if people after we got married would say, oh, you're trying for a baby yet? It took me a good 10 months to a year to start saying to people, do you know what, actually we are and it's not happening. It's the hardest question. It's the one that everyone asks you once you get married. So when are you going to start trying for a baby?
Do you specifically not ask that question now?
Yeah, I don't ask that question at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember because the first time, my first pregnancy ended in a miscarriage. And I remember getting a bit annoyed when people say, you're going to have a baby soon. I say, oh, I actually had a miscarriage. And that would often sort of make them sit back and think, you know, it's a really personal question. It's basically saying, are you having lots of sex? Mm. I mean, you wouldn't ask that to, you know, to, to most people. So it's extraordinary. Well, I really admire you for opening up. One other thing that really struck me about when you talk about your childhood is how the fact that your father, Richard Branson, would go and do these crazy trips around the world. So he hot air ballooned around the world, didn't he? He was he trying did. To be
he,
the first
he
person.
Attempted to.
He attempted to. Yeah, so he was attempting to be the first person to have you know, crossed the, gone around the globe in a hot air balloon.
Yeah, so he initially broke the world record for the Atlantic crossing, yeah. First person to cross the Atlantic, then broke the world record for the first person to cross the Pacific, and then attempted the around the world. I think it was something like 5 times, but unfortunately got beaten in the last minute by another team.
And how did you feel about all of this? I mean, because obviously there's, as a child of a parent who has these ambitions, you know, A, they're not there, but B, they're risking their lives. Do you remember how you felt about it at the time?
So for the first few ones, my mum was amazing and completely kept us out of the loop. We didn't even go and see him off. We were probably under 10. And she was very much the rock that just sort of kept our home life as normal as possible. For the later ones, for the around the world ones, we were older. We were 11 to 16 for all the attempts, and we would go and see him. And I just remember my brother and I coping differently. I was much more of a don't show my emotions, but I would not leave my dad's side for the 4 days before he would set off. Whereas my brother was a bit more open with it, wears his heart on his sleeve. And I've just got this vision of one of the pictures taken of literally the moment dad was taking off Sam, just in floods of tears. So, was it definitely tough, but I think easier than it would have been if it was now, because there's no social media back then.
Mm.
So when my mum was trying to protect us, she really did protect us. We were under 10, we weren't reading the newspaper or watching the news. So we sort of didn't see all the things that were going on around it. Whereas nowadays, I think it'd be much harder to keep your kids away from it.
And did you ever discuss the risks? Were you aware of? I mean, it's a dangerous thing, circumnavigating the globe in a hot air balloon.
We didn't discuss the risks.
And were
I'm
you
not
aware
sure whether that's
them?
The right thing or not, actually, looking back. We probably should have sat down as a family and been a bit more open with our emotions to maybe deal with it better. We were very much sort of stiff upper lip, although that we're not a family that's a stiff upper lip family, but it was very much just everything's going to be okay. Everything's going to be okay, until a few years later when I read my dad's autobiography and I saw on the first page was a letter he'd written to us in case he didn't come back. And that's when the first time I ever cried about the trips, because I suddenly had the realization of, you know, things might not have been okay.
Yeah. Cause obviously I had that very conversation with Ben. He went to climb Everest this year, and listen, I think parenting has changed a lot in this century, and I think we are probably a bit more aware of the emotional side of ourselves and how important it is to nurture them. But I really struggled with how honest am I with the children, you know, what do I tell them? And in the end, Ben and I both felt that we did owe it to be honest with them and say, listen, there are risks. Because I remember overhearing a conversation, one of Ludo's friends said, your daddy's climbing Everest, that means he'll definitely die. And I was like, and then Ludo went, no, he definitely won't die. And I was like, okay, well, both of you are wrong here. And I took Ludo aside and I did have that conversation with him. And I think it was probably a good thing to do, because it meant that he knew I'd answer his questions honestly. And that also meant that I could control his anxiety, mm-hmm. because he trusted me.
Yeah, and he could be open with you if he was feeling sad or worried or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever been tempted to follow in your father's footsteps and do something that's a big challenge like that?
Absolutely. I've definitely got the adventurous gene. So a few years ago, I climbed Mont Blanc to launch our charity Big Change. I've attempted to cross the Atlantic on a sailboat to break the world record for the fastest sailboat crossing. That was the scariest thing I've ever done.
Was this since having your children?
None of these things have been since having children. So it just timings haven't worked out for me to do. So my whole family just climbed Mont Blanc again in September, but because I'm pregnant, I couldn't do it. So I haven't had to make these big decisions of like, am I going to put myself in this situation now I've had kids. I have done lots of adventures, but not ones that are life-threatening. I've cycled the length of Italy.
And do you feel that potentially your outlook has changed since you're a mother? You know, thinking about some of the more risky ones, would you think
I would weigh them up. I'd think a lot more and I'd have to weigh it up a lot more. At the age of the kids are now, if something happened to me, they probably wouldn't remember me. And I think that would really stop me wanting to take that risk. I'd have to see if the opportunity came about, but I think deep down I know my answer would be no.
And did you ever resent your father taking these risks?
I didn't.
Did you admire him?
Yeah, I did. I admired him. I honestly think I had the utmost belief that he was going to be fine. Looking back now, I just actually had the opportunity to quiz him, because I did a meet the author with my dad where I interviewed him quite candidly, and I really quizzed him about why he did the challenges, and especially with such young children, and how could he take those risks that he might not come back. But his answer was very much, for him that's living life. He was pushing boundaries, he was breaking world records, he was doing things for the first time, and he had the faith that he would come back as well.
Yeah. I mean, Ben is a great believer in all of that too. He says, you know, life without a risk is no life. And I want to teach the children in our increasingly risk-averse society that it is okay to take risks. And, you know, you might not be lucky, but it's probably worth the risk. And obviously you've got to quantify your risks and you've got to take the appropriate precautions. But crossing a road is a risk in life. Driving to the airport is often more dangerous than the actual flight. And it's sometimes important to have, you know, think about what it gives back to you.
And how were your kids when they went, when Ben goes away?
I think they're very excited. For him, for them, I think he's like a sort of superhero. You know, all their friends want to talk to him, and he comes and does talks at their school, and then he has books and pictures, and he took their favorite toys to the top of Everest. They see the exciting part of it.
Do you follow the journey while he's gone?
Yes, I do, and I do tell them quite a lot, and I do have sort of honest conversations. But then I also have sort of weepy moments where I just need to be alone. I'll go for a run and I'll just get all that emotion out, and probably not in front of them, because you know, some of these things are too sophisticated for them to understand. But I think also as they grew up, you know, I will be more honest with them about my emotions. And I do cry in front of them, and I do sort of admit to them that I'm not always strong and happy, and sometimes I do have a bit of a low day. But I think when they're younger, you probably shield them more than that.
Mm. Yeah, I had a hormonal moment the other day where I just started crying for no apparent reason whatsoever. And they both looked at me completely shocked, like, you know, why are you crying, mommy? And I actually didn't stop, and I just said, you know, I'm just feeling a bit emotional today.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that is really important to show your kids, that it's okay to cry. Because if you're always a rock and don't show your emotions, how do they learn that they're allowed to show their emotions too?
Well, you know, people talk about us modeling behavior for our children, and essentially they do model all their behavior on us, from starting from smiling to talking and eating and politeness and vocabulary. But that, you know, I was interestingly talking to a psychotherapist, Julia Samuel, the other week, and she was saying how, you know, when you're grieving, it's really important for parents to grieve in an open way, because you are then modeling good grieving and good control of your, not control, but embracing of your emotions that your children will then mirror. Mm. And that, of course, made complete sense. But I was definitely brought up in that stiff upper lip household where, you know, don't cry and don't be a baby. Whereas we know crying is so important. Mm. It's amazing how it's changed in a generation, isn't it? That we're sitting there having this conversation. I mean, I cannot imagine my parents having this conversation. That was 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Yeah.
In terms of talking about actually our parents, you know, you talk about how, you know, your mother was a very present mother. She was a stay-at-home mother and you loved having her around. You obviously lead a very different life. You know, you have many fingers in many pies and are extremely busy. How does that sit with you? Do you, I mean, I think all of us feel that guilt that we're just not quite a good enough mother, and that I slightly wrestle that I'm not present enough for my children, even though I try so hard. Mm. Do you have those struggles?
Yeah, definitely. And especially when I first went back to work, I did have the guilt that I wasn't being the best parent I could be. And as you say, especially because my mom was a stay-at-home mom and she was there for everything. She picked us up from school for every pickup, drop off. But I really try to suppress the guilt because I know my husband doesn't feel guilty when he walks out the door Monday to Friday to go to work. And we are getting into a society nowadays where men and women are becoming much more equal in home life, work life. And I want to model that for the kids as well. I think that's really important. I think it's really important they see me working. Mm.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're so right that, you know, that the men in our lives don't feel guilty. I had this conversation with Iona the other day and she went, "Mummy, why do you choose to go to work? Why do you specially choose to spend time away from us when you can?" And I was like, "Iona, I only work like one or two evenings a week and I am there whenever I can and I'm so present and I'm, you know..." And you never give daddy this shit. I'm sorry, it's so unfair. And you do, you talk about kind of yeah. mother guilt, but we don't really talk about dad guilt.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it is changing. Obviously, a lot more women in our generation are working and, you know, doing really fulfilling, important jobs that, you know, I find working makes me, is a large part of who I am. I'm more than just their parents.
I think as long as your kids are happy and healthy, it doesn't matter what way they're being brought up, whether it's childcare, nannies, school, you know, who's taking care of them, as long as they're happy and healthy. And I think if you're fulfilled, they are going to be happier kids because of it. Luckily, I think also, you know, men are doing a lot more at home as well. So that does make work-life balance a lot easier. And I think it's really good for my kids to see that Freddie cooks, and he takes them to school, and like, I'm very lucky I work for a company that's fully flexible working, so I'm not missing out on the nativity play or the sports day, which are the things that you would traditionally feel really guilty for missing.
So
I think if more and more companies could actually look after their employees more and make it easy for people to one day a week, 2 days a week drop their kids off at school or nursery, go to these important events, because you can work from anywhere now.
You can work from anywhere. And I don't know if you found this, but after having children, when I went back to work, my God, I became efficient. You know, I could get what took me a day to do done in like 3 hours because I was so focused. And also, I really wanted to get home for a certain time. So I wasn't going to have a lunch break. I wasn't going to go and sit and have a long coffee. I was going to get the work I needed to done. And I think that is the case for many women. They are hyper-efficient after they've had children. And that's a brilliant thing to be able to harness as a company, presumably.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, men taking paternity leave. So more and more men are doing the shared paternity leave. And I think it's so important to try and help women to progress within business. Because if it's just the women that takes the leave, it's the men that then progress. We've got an equal policy at Virgin where if a man wants to take 100% of his leave, so the full 50 weeks full pay, he can instead of his wife doing it. And I think if you've just got that equal gender balance, it does make home life much easier.
We've talked a bit on the podcast about that sort of return to work and sort of expectations of your working life and how they potentially change after you have children. I mean, I remember with me, when I was pregnant with Ludo, I sort of merrily said to the company I was working for, I'll take 6 weeks and I'll be back full time. And it was only when I was back that I had Ludo, I was like, I mean, this is not going to happen. Did you have any preconceptions that were sort of, totally dispelled after you'd had children?
I think because I was having two at the same time, I was definitely under the impression I was going to be taking more time off than if I had one. And then when it actually happened, I did take 9 full months off work. But looking back on it, I don't think that I'd do that again this time because I felt that was too long. I'd lost lots of confidence. I went back to work feeling, and it's a business that it's very much part of my family. And I still felt completely... completely out of confidence and it took me a long time to get back into the groove of working again. And I don't know whether that's hormonal, lack of sleep, or it was because it was at 9 months I went back part-time and a year I went back full-time. This time we'll see if things change, but this time I'm planning to go back a bit earlier.
Yeah, part-time initially.
Yeah. And when I say earlier, I mean I'm aiming for 6 months and we'll see what happens.
But I think that lack of confidence, it's so interesting for me to hear your perspective because it's something I talk about on the Bump Class. And I think people, when they're pregnant, you know, loving their jobs and quite high powered and making a real difference, find that quite hard to believe. But, you know, like you said, you spend 6 to 9 months being a mum and not dressing in the same way and not interacting in the same way and using different vocabulary and using your brain in a different way. I think everyone, whoever they are, will suffer that sort of lack of confidence. And it's really interesting hearing you. I mean, I think a lot of people would have looked at you and thought, well, there's no way Hollywood lack confidence going back into the workplace. And yet, you know, it just shows that it does affect us all, regardless of, you know, what your role is within the company.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And I do quite a bit of public speaking, and having not done that for over a year, that was a huge step back. So I really want to make sure I keep on doing that as much as possible. And what's quite cool is because of shared parental leave, going back to work, I don't feel bad about it because Freddie and I are going to share some of the parental leave. He's going to do a couple of months with me at the same time. And I think it's great to set that example within the office and with other men that, you know, men can do this too. And it doesn't have to be just the woman that's doing the childcare.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because while, you know, the law says one thing, the expectation is often very, very different.
The cultural norm is so different. And even just 3 years ago, when we had Etta and Artie, when I broached the topic with Freddie, he was like, absolutely not. I can't do that. No other men are doing that. You know, it might affect my career. And you think, you know, it might affect my career too, taking this time out. But it's just amazing. So in just 3 years, we have quite a lot of examples at Virgin of men that have done this and have really enjoyed taking time out to be a proper dad with their family. And I'm so happy that Freddie's agreed to do it this time too.
Did you do it last time?
No.
See, 3 years makes all the difference.
It does. No, yeah. It really does. No. And he was absolutely, I'm not doing this last time. Mm. And this time he's fully embracing it and really excited about it. And we're going to do it not quite at the beginning, because at the beginning, babies do predominantly need their mum, especially if you're breastfeeding. Whereas a bit later on, it can be much easier for the man to get involved and be very much a stay-at-home hands-on dad. And so we're going to wait till about 3 or 4 months and then he's going to take his time off then.
Great initiative. So I want to talk a little bit about your book. You've said how children have the most amazing ability to teach adults the true joy of being alive. What have your children taught you in the 4 years?
They've taught me that I do love sleep. I don't function very well when I don't get it. Kids, I think having a boy and a girl at the same time.
Because you didn't know you were having a boy and a girl.
I didn't know I was having a boy and a girl. And I think having the two of them at exactly the same time has just taught me how you've got to be quite careful about the way you speak to children, the words you use. When Etta was only 2 years old, Freddie said to her, "Oh, Etta, you're so clever." She said something and he went, "You're so clever." And she went, "Daddy, I'm not clever, I'm pretty." At two. And so we suddenly both had to check ourselves and be like, where she got that from? And, you know, we've got to really, really be careful that we're not forming these like, "Oh, Artie, you're so big and strong, and Etta, you're so pretty." Because obviously we've been doing that without realizing it. So it's just been really interesting watching boys and girls grow up at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, your kids are very close together. It must be quite similar for you.
Yeah, and it is. And I wrote an article recently about how I don't call Iona pretty. I don't use the P word. And it was amazing, the response. And I felt I'd written quite a sort of well-rounded argument justifying why I felt like that. And it wasn't that I was mean or that I didn't think she was pretty, but I just thought I can use so many more constructive and productive adjectives that are not going to kind of perpetuate the idea that essentially she is what she looks like. Mm-hmm. You know, she's so much more than what she looks like. And, you know, beauty is a social construct that changes from generation to generation. I mean, from decade to decade it changes. And why do we foist this upon women still, you know, in this enlightened age that we're living in? But I was amazed, you know, I even went on TV to talk about it. And I was amazed how many people felt that I was cruel. And yet I feel that I am being the kindest mother by saying, you know, praising Iona for her kindness and her, you know, integrity and her tenacity and being brave rather than what I feel that she looks like.
Yeah, it's hard though, because especially other people who aren't having the thought process, you know, little girls wear little pretty dresses, especially my daughter is a very girly girl. I was never a girly girl. I was such a tomboy. But she's a very girly girl. And so when she comes down in her pretty dresses, most people say, "Oh, Etta, that's a pretty dress. And don't you look great?" And then Artie comes down in his combat trousers and they're like, "Oh, you look so cool." You know, there's just these cultural norms and society of what you say to children.
And do you ever mention that to people?
I do. No, I do now. Because of that comment that Etta made when she was two, I really do. I really think it's so important that little girls especially don't just think it's just important if I'm pretty. I couldn't believe it. "No, Daddy, I'm not clever. I'm pretty."
And the book is obviously talking about, you know, how having a social conscience that goes beyond the kind of norm will sort of positively impact, you know, your business. Translating that into parenting, have you given much thought about, I'm sure you have, about how we can create, you know, I look at my children, they are incredibly privileged, you know, just considering the fact that they have a roof over their head and there's always food on their plate. How do we make sure that our children, you know, emerge as aware of how lucky they are and aware that they aren't, you know, most of the children in the world aren't like that? And also, interestingly, I'm reading a Michelle Obama's autobiography at the moment. And, you know, she very much had, right from the beginning, this urge that, you know, she just didn't want to be a corporate lawyer. She wanted to be something more than that. How do we I would love to instill that in my children. How do we do that? What are your tips?
Well, I think it's all a learning process. But I think for all children, no matter what background you're brought up in, I think all kids have to have the realization that they can make a difference in the world. And it's been interesting. Recently, the kids have just done a project at school on the environment, and they've been so fascinated by it. You know, plastic waste, climate change, making sure you turn off the lights at home. And I think if we can all try and get kids interested in those really important topics from a very young age, and in a fun way, it doesn't have to be, you know, let's sit down and learn this. It's in a really fun way. I think it's in a really important, and getting out into your local community, making sure they understand the concept of giving back. As soon as I read a great article about pocket money, and we're not quite there yet, but as soon as we are, I'm definitely going to be doing this. It was someone who said you should always make your pocket money divisible by three. Give your kids three jars. One is save, so they put one of the 20p's in save. One is spend, and they can do whatever they want with it. Let's say you're giving them 60p, put the other 20p in spend, and the other is giveaway. And so they get to choose when it gets to a certain amount of money, any charity or any cause that they feel really strongly about that they can give it away. And I thought that was a really good way of getting kids to understand the concept of saving and giving back, but also had the fun bit about letting them go and buy their Kinder Egg if they want to as well.
Yeah, no, that makes such sense, because I slightly struggle. My children don't really spend any of their pocket money, so it accumulates. And also toys are really expensive these days. But I did say to Ben the other day, I think our children have way too much pocket money. And then he Googled what the national average was, and it was actually below the national average. But it just still feels really uncomfortable that, you know, they have all this money and they don't really think about it. So actually, that's a brilliant
idea.
It's
a really nice, I really, really loved it. I thought it was a really nice concept. And there's just also, I think it's just making these topics really fun and interesting for them, going to the science museum and learning things there. And there's so many free museums and free events that happen in towns and cities, and just trying to look them up and find fun ways on weekends to go about doing it. There's schools now that are taking kids down the Thames to pick up rubbish. There's other things. There's one actually that we support a big change called 50 Things to Do Before You're Five. And because sometimes it's quite hard to come up with these concepts. I mean, I'm not creative at all. So I spend a lot of time Googling about, you know, what things can I do this weekend that are about plastic waste. And fortunately, Google is amazing, and it pops up with the answers normally. And so, but there's this charity called 50 Things to Do Before You're Five. And it gives you great examples of what things to do with your kids to just enlighten them.
Yeah, because they've got to care. You know, I think that's the important thing. I think if we force them to sort of give to charity, we want to get them to want to do it. And so sort of I suggested to my children's school, who have a sort of charity, there should almost be like an X factor for the charity, you know, that the different groups of children should select a charity and then try and persuade each other why this should be their charity of the year. And then that kind of combines the research and the passion, and then also a bit of sort of public speaking. But then also that drive that, you know, it's not just giving the money that you're given, but thinking, right, well, how can I generate more money? You know, am I going to make lemonade, and then I can give the profits of the or half the profits of the lemonade, or whatever it is, to the charity. And that sort of feels like it's me being a slightly better parent and enforcing. I mean, the power of instilling these things young is tremendous. And I remember so well being taught about sort of, you don't drop litter in the street. And, you know, I wouldn't drop litter in the street in the same way that I wouldn't kick a dog. You know, it's so against. And yet you see people do that. And that sort of, and I think it's so great that our children are so engaged with the environment, because that hopefully will make all the difference, because quite frankly, our generation aren't brilliant.
No, and hopefully there'll be the push for the future to try and push businesses to decrease their plastic pollution, which is a great thing that's happening at the moment. And all down to David Attenborough and his program, because it's been talked about for ages. But then when that Blue Planet came out, there was that real sea change. Pardon the pun. real sea change of people really understanding that this is a massive problem. And it was really pushed by young people.
Absolutely. And you look at a lot of the companies that are engaging with young people. You know, look at Innocent Smoothies, for example. You look at their packaging, and it's all about sort of recycling. I was reading one the other day saying, you know, this is going to be turned into a, your you know, your carton is 100% recyclable and it will reinvent itself as a loo roll holder. And I think it's really interesting that those companies that are specifically engaging with younger people are very often the ones that have been the first to take on this challenge and, you know, the most vociferous about it.
Mm. Yeah, so, and I think it's helping your kids find their cause, because it might not be your cause. It might not be the thing that you're passionate about. And I think you've really got to help them to find the things that they're passionate about, and then they're most likely to make the biggest difference.
And is this a conversation you've had with your children about finding their, or are they just a bit
they're,
young?
They're just that little bit too young, but I do love the fact that they, at the moment, it's the environment and plastic, and they really are. And if we leave the lights on, they're telling us to turn the lights off. So they're actually now teaching us, you know, they're forcing us to be better people as well at three.
And philanthropy is obviously a big part of what you and your family do. Was it always a narrative within your family, you know, choosing a charity, this sort of division of the pocket money? Was this always something you had talked about? Or?
No, the division of the pocket money was that's just something I've read about recently. But the giving back was always something that was very much ingrained in what we do. It wasn't a formalized chat, like a dinner table conversation, but we just sort of, as you just learn from your parents and what they do. It was a lot of making sure, when I was little, I would always notice my dad would give to the big issue sellers and get one of the big issue papers, and he'd always make sure he was giving presents to hospitals at Christmas time. I do remember when I had a big birthday party when I was sort of 4 years old. I got ridiculous amounts of presents. When you have a big party, everyone brings a present, and it was sort of choosing which presents were going to go to charity and which ones I was going to keep. So it did start very young, and so I'm trying to do that with the kids now. It's so hard to get them to give away their toys, but I think if you explain it in a way about people just not having as much as them, and how it's really important to share and give things,
and really how giving is way better than receiving, and you realize that when you're older, but you just need to think about it in a certain way. I know I had this thought, you know, that Ludo should give a certain amount of his presents away, but I also said it can't be your worst present, kind of should be your favorite present, because you're giving to people that have so much less than you. And I was like, God, is that just too mean to say to a little sensitive boy who, you know. Anyway, it was a difficult conversation.
It's very
to have.
Difficult, because it's also difficult because people have thought about what gifts they're giving him. So they've spent the time thinking, well, you know, what's he going to like? Mm. And then if they then found out, you've just given it on. Mm. So I'm the same. I've had these similar thoughts a lot. But I think doing ones where they've grown out of them is a bit more understandable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you going to do that?
His birthday. I think we'll definitely do one or two. And I think as they get older, you know, I think it's very difficult to have that conversation with a 4-year-old, but actually with a 9-year-old, I think actually that they have realized that giving, like the excitement of finding a great present for someone you love, is so much more rewarding than whatever you're given. I think they are starting to realize, and to give something to someone and you know it's going to make a big difference feels so good, and I think they're starting to feel that. But you know, I also don't want them to resent me and feel that I'm Captain No Fun. And you know,
and would you go with them to wherever you're going to give the presents to? They would get them to go with you?
Yeah absolutely, because then that's
that's all the understanding, isn't it?
Exactly. So you have started a charity, Big Change. Tell me a bit about what the ambitions for the charity is and what it does.
So 5 years ago, we set up Big Change because we wanted to really rethink the education system in the UK specifically. We back sort of big ideas and great people who are doing wonderful things, and we partner with them financially and also by convening other people in the same area. We call ourselves a social impact accelerator, so we back really early stage ideas that most other people don't want to take the risk on yet, and we've had such a great outcome. So it's ideas that are helping kids thrive in life and not just exams. I feel like the education system at the moment, especially in the state system, it's all about your Ofsted reports, your end of year grades, where your school is on the league tables. And it's, so it's really just pushing these kids to worry. Every year they have to worry about their exam results. And it means the teachers, that's what they're worrying about. So they're not actually focusing on the proper life skills that kids need, like grit and resilience and determination and failure. It's all about what grades can you get and where are our school going to be in the, like, on the league tables. So we've spent 5 years partnering great projects that have really helped kids thrive. And now we're focusing another part of the charity on reimagining education and how we can make education perfect for the 21st century. 'Cause parrot fashion regurgitation is not necessary anymore. Computers can do that for us. But that seems to be what the school system is just set up to do. Teach kids to remember something and then spit it back out again.
And not think.
And not think. No, exactly. There was a great research study done recently on A-level students who all got straight A's. And then they got them to retake the A-levels 3 months later. And 70% of them got D's.
Because they'd forgotten the immediate information.
And what use is that in life? So we're now pulling together and convening the top brains in education from across the globe to really rethink how we can do education better.
And, you know, there are, as I see my children mature, I realise that there are some children that are really good at exams and find them really easy, and some children that aren't. And one group is not necessarily brighter than the other.
And actually, the ones that pass the exams, you know, I wasn't luckily enough to be good at exams. And so I ended up doing well and ended up at university. My brother, on the other hand, was just not interested in exams, but I would say he's brighter than me.
And your father's dyslexic, isn't he?
My dad's dyslexic, yeah. And he was not good at exams either. He left school at 15.
And look at where he is now.
Exactly.
Yeah, it is so interesting. Ben's book about climbing Everest is much more than just the mission to the top. It's about a reflection on his life, and he was exactly that child. He got, you know, D, E, N, I think, in his A-levels. And on paper, he was told, you're going to be a failure in life. Spelling's not good enough, your writing's not good enough, your aptitude when it comes to maths is terrible. And yet, what he realised when he got a little bit more confidence was that the world is a much bigger and broader place than A-levels. But so much is the confidence in that belief that my school has identified me as a loser. My school has identified me as a failure. So that's what I'm going to be. I'm going to be pigeonholed by this education system.
But what's sad is it's still happening now. It hasn't changed. School is all about how you do at exams. And it absolutely shouldn't be.
And so what are the sort of projects and the outcomes that you have funded? Can you give me an example of...
Yep, so we have funded a project that came out of a school called School 21, which is an amazing state school in East London, which was set up and run by a great guy called Ed Fido. And he had an idea that oracy, speaking skills, should be just as important as written skills. All of our exams, apart from some of the languages, are all done by writing, but life is all about speaking. So he has come up with an oracy curriculum, and it's now started and tested in his school, but has now been spread across thousands of schools across the UK. And he's really lobbying that many more of the exams, if we're going to stick with the exam system, should be actually oral. There's a horrific stat that in some state schools, kids speak on average 3 to 4 words in a lesson. And it's all about the teacher just standing at the front and shoveling information into the heads of the young people. And they don't actually get to sit there and discuss, and because there isn't time. So his oracy curriculum has been absolutely phenomenal. Another project we funded was one called Frontline, which... was an idea at the time, and it was about getting really highly qualified people to become social workers. Being a social worker doesn't have the kudos that it should do. It's such an important role. And so he started a guy we know started something to do what Teach First did for teaching for social work. And that was an amazing, we gave them a bit of money and lots of convening power at the beginning, and they went on to get multi-million pound funding from the government, and it's now a national project. So it's just taking these people with great ideas and giving them the sort of support they need at the beginning to then go on to make a big difference.
Yeah, and giving them the voice, yeah. You know, because so often you have this great idea and you lack the confidence and sort of thinking, the ease in which to make it kind of national. But the oracy thing, it makes total sense. You know, the majority of our life is about one-to-one communication. I'm a big believer that communicating with my children is the best skill I can give them. Teaching them to look in the eye and to be able to say, I'm sorry, or I'm sad, or I'm vulnerable, or whatever it is, that is way more important than times tables, because quite frankly, I've forgotten them all.
Yeah.
I've been relearning them since I've been teaching to my children. I'm like, six, sevens, oh God, I can't remember. And yet we attach so much importance to them.
Yeah. 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 And then the other areas that we're really focusing on at the moment are teacher well-being. Teacher burnout is huge. And you put all this time and effort into to training up teachers, and then a lot of them, I think it's something like 2/3 of them, are leaving within 5 years because the profession is just so difficult and there's not enough support. So making sure that teachers have the support and getting, because schools don't have HR departments and the teachers are the most important bits of a school. Yeah, we're just trying to focus on the areas that are really needed within the education system and giving them as much support as we can.
Holly, it's been so great to chat to you. I have really, really enjoyed it. Holly's book, Weconomy, is available from Amazon and all the good bookshops. If you want to hear more about Big Change, go to big-change.org. And you can follow Holly on Instagram at Holly_Branson. Thank you for downloading another episode of The Parenthood. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate and review us. These three clicks make a huge difference to how easily people can find us. But in the meantime, from Holly and me, thanks for listening and goodbye.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.